Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and joining Simon and I today is This Is Money's pensions specialist, Tanya Jeffries, and a very good job too, because today we've a pension special. We're stripping them back to basics. As auto-enrolment takes centre stage once more, contributions have gone up. What about the self-employed and small business owners? And for those in their 40s and 50s, is it too late for you? No, says Tanya. So whatever your age or employment status, we'll help you get cracking, warn you of the pitfalls, including the government. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
So auto-enrolment is the hot topic of the moment when it comes to pensions. The rate you pay in went up last month, but putting aside the arguments about whether this is nearly enough for a comfortable retirement, free cash from your employer and doing something is not to be sniffed at. But what about the self-employed, the gig economy workers, small business owners, who often put off starting a pension due to pressures on their time, on finances? And if you're in your 40s and your 50s, is it too late to even bother? Well, you've got your pensions columnist, Steve Webb, to help you out, Tanya, to tackle the issue of starting a pension from scratch. Now, this is in response to a reader's query, but I imagine that this is a topic that many, many people come to you and have questions about. But before we get into what the reader said, Steve's advice, Simon, just give me an idea about the landscape at the moment. Why is so much emphasis being put on us? Why is it important to save?
Because if you don't take responsibility for saving for your pension, then unfortunately nobody else will.
How has the circumstances changed from the past? Why are we even saying that statement? In the past, surely it was pretty straightforward.
Well, yes, in the past, our employers used to take a lot more responsibility for our pensions. And also now you have a lot more people who are self-employed. But the old days of final salary pensions, in fact, the old days where companies would brag about how good their pension scheme was to encourage people to join the company. So you would go to a company and the company would interview you, and then when it wanted you as a candidate, they'd come to you and they'd say, yes, and we'll offer you this and that in terms of salary, but our pension scheme, this is our pension scheme, it's great. You know, it was a real point of honour for companies to offer great pension schemes. Unfortunately, gradually got whittled away over the years. There's
Why?
A number of things that happened. Firstly, there was a presumption that stock markets would continue to do well and that interest rates would continue to be high. So the generous promises that final salary pensions made, and that means that they promised to pay you a certain amount of money every year for the rest of your life, probably to your spouse as well, if you died. And you'd accrue that perhaps at a rate of 1/60th. For every year that you worked for a company. So if you worked for a company for 40 years, you'd get to retire on 40/60ths or 2/3 of your final salary. It might have also been on your average career earnings or other things. And these were known as defined benefit pensions because they defined the benefit that you would get and the company was responsible for it. But obviously that kind of promise is expensive. It's less expensive when the stock market is doing well and the money that the company needs to set aside and invest to pay to meet that promise is going up. And it's less expensive when interest rates are high because the bonds that companies buy usually to maintain those promises were paying higher rates of interest. Stock markets didn't do as well as people thought. Interest rates ended up on a sort of 25-year downward slope. And there was a couple of mistakes that were made along the way. The Thatcher government gave companies the ability to take payment holidays into their pensions because, astonishingly, looked at from the perspective that we have now, companies were considered to have too much money in their pension schemes rather than being in deficit. Gordon Brown, as Chancellor, changed the taxation on dividends, which was another major hit to pension schemes. And finally, we had the financial crisis and the bailout of the banks and the slashing of interest rates down to record low levels and almost to zero, which led to government bond yields taking an absolute tumble and the cost of those delivering on those pension promises becoming much more expensive. Ironically as well, what has also happened is the further bond yields have fallen, the more cautious companies have got and the more money they've put into those bonds rather than investing in the stock market, which if they had invested in the stock market after the financial crisis, they'd probably have a lot more money in their pension pots. So the responsibility gradually shifted onto us, and we got a thing called defined contribution pensions, where what's defined is the contribution that goes in. You put in a certain amount, your employer puts in a certain amount. If you're lucky, they match what you put in. If you're really lucky, they might even double it. You get the tax relief from the government. It all goes into a pot and you have to invest that pot to build up a sum of money with which you are then responsible for delivering your own income in retirement.
Very well explained, Simon. Thank you very much for that. So that is where we are, Tanya. We then got auto-enrolment, didn't we? And I want to know from you, a saving grace or a saving disaster waiting to happen?
Oh, no, auto-enrolment is definitely a good thing. The inertia people feel towards pensions is very great indeed. And if your company signed you up automatically, you will nearly always go along with it. It's very rare that people opt out. Now, individual contributions have now gone up. They've tripled to 2.4%. That's what people are paying now from April. And the opt-out rate may go up, but I think the politicians and the pension companies and everybody interested in this are banking on the fact that everybody will just stick with it because it's the easy option.
Now, people might be listening and thinking, why on earth am I slamming this? I'm not at all. I think it's a great idea. But some of the criticism is 2.4%. Well, that's not even remotely close to where you would need to be for a comfortable retirement. And what it might do is almost disincentivize you once you tick that box, you're in, you're paying a little bit, to add any more to it.
Yes, that's true. But I think you have to be realistic as to what people can afford. The ones on the very lowest pay are not going to be able to afford the tripling. I mean, if it's a choice between paying your rent and putting food on the table and paying into your pension, you are literally not going to be able to afford this tripling to 2.4%. On the other side of it, yes, it should. All being equal, people should be putting more in, and it is going up again next year. We're taking this hit next year and it's going to go up again next year. So we'll have to see what happens over the long term, but something is better than nothing.
Yes, indeed. But inevitably, with any sort of policy like this, there are people who are left behind. Auto-enrolment is great in terms of getting an employer contribution, but what if you are self-employed, gig economy workers, etc., etc.? And also some people who have a number of lower paid jobs are not also included into this scheme. Is that right?
Yes, you have to have at least 10,000 from one job. And they are looking at changing it so that if you have multiple jobs that come to over 10,000, or even if you're under 10,000 and want to opt in, you would be able to do it. But that's still some time off. People are worried about it, but the government isn't really doing anything in the near term about it.
Well, that's it, Simon. I want to know, have the self-employed business owners ever been ignored by the government, and what can be done in this regard?
Well, you have to start somewhere. So the government started with the place that it was easiest to start, which is employed people, because you can tell companies to do things and then they have to do it. The way that the self-employed really miss out is, of course, that they don't get employer contributions. And actually, what you will find for a lot of people who've been auto-enrolled into pensions is, yes, there are these minimum contributions. But I don't know whether it's true that it's most companies percentage-wise, but most good companies will pay considerably more into your pension than they are required to by the bare minimum of auto-enrolment. Obviously, if you're self-employed, you're looking to save money where you can. And particularly if you go from being employed to self-employed, all of a sudden you look at the £500 a month that was going into your pension and you go, I can't afford that. Where am I going to find £500 a month? Money's tight. I'm setting up my business. And then it becomes very easy to just sort of keep kicking the can down the road. The answer to that is that, unfortunately, if you don't deal with this and consider this as an essential expense of your small business, your self-employment, your role as a sole trader, then no one else is going to do it for you. And after that initial gap, you need to, when you're setting up your business, you need to start doing it as soon as possible, get that money out of your account as a direct debit every month. Because otherwise, you're going to find that a year has passed, 2 years has passed, but then it's 5 years, and then it's 10 years, and then you missed out on 10 years.
And the joy of compounding as well, which
you talk about. And the earlier you start paying money into a pension, the easier it gets. The longer you leave it, the harder it gets. My wife was in this exact situation. She left employment, started up on by herself. She was fortunate enough to have worked for Tesco, which had a defined benefit scheme for most of the time that she was working there, which bought her a bit of time because luckily that's built, you know, you get up better pension out the back of it. But I said to her, look, you can leave it 6 months a year, but once you've done that, you need to start paying money in. And really, you probably need to be paying in at least 10% of your earnings, which is going to sound like a lot of money to most people. But you maybe start lower and try and work your way up to that. But you do need to be doing it.
There are certain rules of thumbs, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty, but it's just briefly, Tanya, it's not just self-employed business owners that are going to have these dilemmas in their head. It's also young people or people wanting to perhaps get on the property ladder. Perhaps you have taken time out to have children. I mean, everybody's at different stages in their lives with different pressures. Thinking about the future must seem a million miles off.
There's always a reason not to do it. And it's not only financial. I think there's a bureaucratic stumbling block in people's head. There's a psychological barrier. They really don't want to have to deal with the paperwork. Most people don't know a lot about pensions, so they have to learn about pensions before they can even get started. Mm. I think with people who are going from jobs to self-employed, we've not only had a really good column with a to-do list from our pensions columnist, Steve Webb, but also Kate Smith from Aegon has written for us this week about how to do it. And she's come up with a very simple approach for people who are leaving jobs to set up and become self-employed, which is look at all your old pensions and see which ones will let you carry on paying in. You won't get the employer contributions anymore, but it takes all the bureaucratic hassle out of it if you can just say, ring them up and say, okay, I want to carry on paying in, job done. And then you can do the out of sight, out of mind thing that other people do when they're employed, which where the inertia comes into play, where you just stop thinking about it. You set it up, you stop thinking about it.
Okay, on to the reader query and your pensions expert, Steve Webb, who has been answering and has done for some time now a lot of readers' queries. What specifically did this reader want to know?
She had got about £1,000 in a pension pot, an old auto-enrolment scheme, but she was 32, was setting up on her own, and was obviously a loss as just to how to get started. So Steve provided her with some sort of building blocks just to get going, and it was quite straightforward what you need to think about, what the charge is going to be, what might you invest in. If you end up not just paying into an old pension scheme that you've left, as I described before, but having to set up your own pension plan, there are a lot of off-the-shelf packages of investments, so you don't necessarily have to do lots of homework about investments. You just need to decide what kind of investor you are and buy one of the sort of prepaid little packages for, say, a medium risk investor and go with that. They try and make it quite easy for you so that you're just buying things off the shelf as opposed to having to learn about how to invest from scratch.
Which that, even listening to you now, and I remember a slightly younger Georgie, not incredibly younger, I wish I had been a little bit younger, just simply trying to find out where to put my money. Where do I go? What do I look for? Simon, there's so many options out there. The company, how do you pick what's right for you?
So basically, if you're going to look at the individual company that you're going to use, there are lots of online platforms out there that will help you start investing. And you've got two choices.
For example,
you either go for one that helps you do it and helps pick some investments for you, and then manages them for you, which will tend to be a little bit more expensive. But companies like Nutmeg, Money Farm, Wealthify, and also then some of what are known as DIY investing platforms, where you can pick your own investments, but they'll have model portfolios that help you. Those are names like Hargreaves Lansdown, Interactive Investor, AJ Bell.
Some people might listen to those names and go, they don't register with me, right? And we're talking about my pensions in years and years and years to come. Can I trust them?
Yes, you can. So go to thisismoney.co.uk/platforms, where you will find our guide to the best DIY investing platforms, and you will find a tool to help you find which will be the cheapest for you. I've written about this before in terms of starting investing, and some of the ones that I have recommended, because they're easy to use. They're good value. Some are more expensive than others, but some give you more help along the way. Are Hargreaves Lansdown, a little bit more expensive than the others, charges you 0.45% of the amount of money that you've got invested. If you've only got a small amount of money invested, then a percentage charge isn't too expensive because it's only a percentage of a small amount. AJ Bell, a bit more of a pared back experience. It only charges 0.25% of what you've got invested, but you do have to pay to buy and sell funds. Interactive Investor has a different model where it charges you £22.50 a quarter or £90 a year. So it's a flat charge. That's more expensive percentage-wise on smaller amounts that you have invested, but it's simple. But you have to pay to buy investments. And Vanguard, which is the king of passive investing, really simple passive investing, that's cheap with a 0.15% per year charge and has no charges for buying or selling. Go to one of these companies. Others are available. You set up your account and you follow the steps to set up what's called a SIP, a self-invested personal pension, and they will walk you through it, and it's very easy. You decide how much money you want to invest, and with Hargreaves Lansdown, for example, you could invest from as little as a lump sum of £100 or £25 a month. So you can start low, and then you can do something. You then have to choose your investments, but that doesn't have to be difficult. They can either help you, or you can just choose, if you're starting out and you're younger, a global tracker fund. This invests in stock markets all around the world, spreads your money in those markets all around the world for a very, very cheap cost potentially. So you've got a Fidelity one, which charges just 0.13%. There's an HSBC one that charges 0.16%. So you could buy one of those two funds. Other funds are available. This is not advice to do that. But if you do this, you'll simply be investing your money all around the world, and you'll trust in the ability of companies to put money to productive use and grow profits over time, which everything we know from the past indicates that they can do. You put your money in every month, and eventually in 30 or 40 years' time, you'll thank yourself for having done it.
I guess the key to this, Tanya, is just get cracking. The best advice I had from someone was just pick something. Just start putting your money in, and then you'll get more engaged.
Yes, you just have to do it. And even if you are in your 40s and 50s and haven't got a pension, it's still worth doing. Compound interest will still work for you from that age onwards. Okay, you could think, okay, if I'd started this when I was 18, I'd have had, you know,
oh,
so
just
much
don't think
more,
like that.
But you
don't
mustn't
think
like
that, people.
The compound interest will work just as well for somebody who is older. So it's just a matter of getting started and getting over that barrier towards doing the admin and then just putting it out of sight.
Really though, I mean, let's talk about the being a bit older. I know you featured on your article, and we spoke about it in a podcast a couple of months back. Ed Monk, formerly of your parish, now of Fidelity, I believe, wrote an article about the fact that you could be in your 40s and 50s and still have a really decent retirement. I mean, is that realistic? And why would you bother putting it there? Could you not invest in other ways? Why a pension?
Because it's tax efficient, and if you're employed, you get the employer contributions and you also get the government contributions. If you're self-employed, you still get the government contributions. Basically, you don't pay any tax on what you put in your pension. It gets paid to you back through tax relief.
So do you actually feel any benefit? What realistically should you be putting away if you're in your, I hate calling it later years because I'm not too far off, your 40s and your 50s?
If you can afford it, you need to start as high as you can if you're coming to it late. But Simon's suggestion of starting with what you can afford and then trying to ratchet it up is a good one, especially if you think you can do it once a year. People who are employed, it's a good idea to up it every time you get a pay rise. And then it feels less painful. Some companies would ratchet it up for you automatically. But yes, ideally, you'd want to go in at a high level if you were just starting, say, in your 40s. But even if you can't, something's better than nothing.
Indeed. In terms of that decision about where you put your money, and I'm thinking perhaps if you're younger and you're trying to decide whether to save for a house, I'm wondering, and we spoke last week about the house price boom, has made people look at housing as a better, almost better investment.
Yes. And in all reality, if you buy a home with a repayment mortgage that you pay off over 25 or 30 years, as is the case for most first-time buyers now, that will prove to be the best investment that you will ever make in your life. Because even if house prices don't go up at all over that entire period, which, to be honest, is quite unlikely over a 30-year period, even if they fell, to be honest, at the end of it, you will own an asset worth hundreds of thousands of pounds, probably, that you can live in for free. And that represents a considerable investment in your life. And there are no other saving schemes or investments that I can think of that involve someone lending you a vast sum of money that is a multiple of your wages to slowly pay back over time with a very, very small rate of interest that ends up with you owning an expensive concrete asset at the end of it that you happen to be able to live in. I'm not suggesting that people buy concrete houses, by the way. However, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be saving into a pension as well, because you can't, whilst you can live in your house for free, you can't live on your house. It doesn't pay you any money to survive.
Unless
you
use a load of schemes, which, you know, we spoke about last week.
So what you want to be doing is at least trying to set aside some money for your pension, even if it's only a little bit. And if you are of younger, dreaming of being a first-time buyer age, if you're in your late 20s or your 30s, then setting aside that small sum of money and then saving it for the next 30 or 40 years makes a really, really big difference. So even if you can just do that £25 a month that we talked about before, or 50, and actually if you, chances are, if you put in 50, your employer matches that 50 and you get £12.50 worth of tax relief. So you've got £112.50 in return for 50 quid. That is a good deal. Take it. And that will compound up over the years and you will hopefully have your pension pot at the end of it. And the only other thing I'd say is, when you start work, you probably feel like you don't have any money to spare. Student debts, credit cards, overdrafts, things like that to pay off, not earning enough money, not getting paid enough. But then as things move on, maybe one day you might get married, you're going to need to save some money for a wedding, then you might have, then you want to save for a house, then you want to save for some kids, and so on and so on. It doesn't necessarily get any easier. So at least if you can just get 50 quid a month out and just start doing it early on and get used
to
it, you'll soon forget that you ever had that 50 quid, because it will go straight out of your account as soon as you get paid. And after a few months, you'll learn to deal with it. And yeah, at the end of it, you'll thank yourself.
Well, talking about options, pensions and investing in a house, we also got a new kid on the ISA block, the LISA, or the Lifetime ISA, or the LISA, if you'd like to call it that, although I don't think that is how you pronounce it. Should you get one of those, what are they, Tanya?
Yes, they are another option that allow you to save for retirement and also put money towards a house at the same time. And you can only really use it for those two things. You can either keep it and draw on it when you're 60, or you can get it out to buy a house earlier. The government pays what it calls a bonus on that, 25%. So similarly to tax relief, it works out pretty much the same. My feeling about them is that they are a really good vehicle for saving for a first home, because you get the extra bonus in. But once you've bought that home, when it comes to saving for retirement, I think it's best to get it all out and spend it on your home, especially if you are employed. If you're self-employed, then maybe it's worth hanging on to as a useful product, because you're still going to get the government bonus and so on. But if you're employed, you get the free employer top-ups, and it's much, much better to have free money than not have free money. So that's the way I'd approach that. It depends on the individual and their circumstances. But for the average person who is wanting to save for their first home, it's useful for that.
All right, I want to ask one final question on the general advice, because there is lots of information on LISAs, on pensions, on your website. Do go on there if you want more information. But a financial advisor, Simon, is it worth it?
Yes, a financial advisor is worth having, in terms of the fact that they can help you think of the things that you might not think of and help you organise your finances. However, a financial advisor will cost you money. Now, a financial advisor will argue that they will bring...
How much money are we talking?
Well, for setting up a pension, it might cost you £1,000, £2,000, depending on the amount of money you're talking about. And if you're just starting out saving with a pension and you don't have a large amount of money, then you're going to eat up a huge amount of your contributions just paying the financial advisor. Now, the financial advisor might be able to say that they'll offer you more value, and that they'll help you do things like get income protection, make sure that you're protected if you lose your job or you fall ill, go through all your finances, work out all the different things you can do. But really, if it's just one task that you are looking to fulfill, which is setting up a pension, for example, you've gone self-employed and you want to set up a pension, I think most people would struggle to justify spending £1,000 or £2,000 that they could pay into their pension on just getting the advice to open a pension, when you could go to one of the aforementioned companies and open a very simple pension yourself. And maybe, you know, a few years down the line, once you've got some money in there, you might want to see an advisor and say, hey, look, am I doing the right thing? Is there something I should be doing better with my money? I'm earning a bit more now. I've got a bit more profit. I could put a bit more in. I could maybe pay off some of my mortgage and all these other things. But when if you're starting out and you don't have much money, you will probably find that it's not going to prove cost effective.
I think where a financial advisor can come in really useful is when you're actually about to retire, because it's got a lot more complicated now. We have this wonderful thing called pension freedom, where we're allowed to pretty much do what we want with our money at retirement. And with a great amount of choice gets a lot of complexity. And I think at that point, as Simon says, there's lots of things that they know that you don't know. And if you don't know it, you just don't know it. And you can fall into all sorts of traps that way. And I think that they are invaluable at that point. Now, speaking for myself, I'd be quite inclined to get them to sort me out at the point of retirement, but not pay them an ongoing retainer, which is a percentage of your pot for years and years and years over retirement. I think I'd want to get them to set it up and say thank you very much and walk away, and then keep an eye on my investments and only go back for another consultation that was paid for if something came up that was really necessary.
All right, meanwhile, you have a story highlighting the importance of not relying on the state pension and taking matters into your own hands. Now, this is about 68-year-old Gillian Chamberlain, who was underpaid £3,765 of payments over 8 years due to a government calculations mess up. Now, thankfully, she's finally got her money back. But this is a worry, isn't it? Millions of people are relying on the state pension calculator when planning their retirement finances and living on this income throughout old age. So, Tanya, tell us a bit more about this story.
Well, this is quite worrying because a lot of people, well, everybody who pays national insurance hopes to end up with a full state pension. And if you pay the maximum amount in, you hope to get the full state pension. If the calculations are wrong, it's very difficult to challenge them. You just don't know whether they're right or not. Now, in this case, this lady had got 16 years of missing credits towards her state pension because her years spent caring for her children had not been counted.
How did she uncover that?
Well, her accountant said it didn't look right. And so she says that she contacted HMRC and the DWP a lot of times over the years trying to get it corrected before she finally persuaded them that they really needed to take a close look at it. And they have now refunded her the missing money for the past 8 years since she retired. Unfortunately, the government hasn't said exactly what went wrong in this case. And now it may well be that one person, a human person, made a data entry error and it was a one-off and all fine. In this case, one person has now had it corrected and we can all move on. Mm. But if a lot of people were affected by the same mistake, then that is a much bigger worry.
Yes, and whilst the state pension forecast is a noble idea, and obviously it's different when it actually comes to actually paying your state pension, which you'd hope they'd get right, the state pension forecast system has been bedeviled by problems as well, which is something that has been triggered by the shift from the old state pension to the new flat rate state pension. But the fact that some people at the moment, well, everybody at the moment, will straddle the two things if they're retiring now. And it has led to some people getting forecasts that they thought were completely wrong and then ending up with pensions that were different amounts of money. So I've heard stories of people who were forecast to get a certain amount of pension, which was lower than they thought they were going to get. And then when their state pension was actually paid, they got considerably more. And they said that they decided the sensible course of action would be not to contact the DWP on that.
Thank you very much, Simon. There's plenty more information and guides on This Is Money website to help you with your retirement savings. And if you have any question for Simon, for Tanya and the team, including Steve Webb, Simon, how can they get in contact?
Go to thisismoney.co.uk/pensions to find our pensions channel. There you'll find Steve's columns and the details of how to get in touch and ask your questions. And if you want to do a little bit more work in finding out about how much you might need to save for retirement and what you might need to do, go to thisismoney.co.uk/pension calculator, where you will find our pension calculator and a whole host of guides to help you get started or make more of the money that you're already putting into a pension.
Thank you very much. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.